We start this evening a study of the book of Lamentations. You'll probably see from your Bible that it has the title The Lamentations of Jeremiah. But in fact, that title was added later. The original title of the book was simply the first word of it. How? It's an exclamation. It's the Hebrew word eka. Oh, how! It's used by Isaiah in chapter 1 of his prophecy. How the faithful city has become a harlot. The first verse of Lamentations is, how lonely sits the city that was once full of people. And that was the title of the book, Eka, oh how. It was only much later that the Lamentations of Jeremiah was used as the name of the book. And in fact, that was a title given because of a misunderstanding of a verse in 2 Chronicles chapter 35 and verse 34, where we read these words, Josiah died, the last godly king of Judah. Josiah died and was buried in the tombs of his fathers, and Judah and Jerusalem mourned for Josiah, because he was greatly loved. Jeremiah also uttered a lamentation for Josiah. And all the singing men and singing women have spoken of Josiah in their lamentations unto this day. And they made these an ordinance in Israel. And behold, they are written in the Lamentations. And so the tradition arose that Jeremiah, having watched the devastation of Jerusalem at the hands of Nebuchadnezzar, wrote these songs of lament that we call the Book of Lamentations. But in fact, there is no real evidence that Jeremiah wrote this book. And the safest thing to assume is that what we have here is a commentary by a watcher on the fall of Jerusalem and the ruin of the temple of God. Here is an eyewitness, and he is standing looking at this heap of rubble that was once the holy city of God. And this mound of stones that was once the temple of the living God. Life has ceased. Worship has ceased. And the watcher sees in these ruins the hand of God and the judgment of God. First of all, on the secular side, on a decadent society and a nation that would not listen to God. And on the spiritual side, a church that had abandoned its God. Outside the church, there used to be heedless multitudes living for the day and living for the pleasures of the day. Inside the church, in that decadent society, there had been false prophets, lying words, and empty, pleasing promises. But now the society has collapsed, and the church has collapsed, and over it all there hangs the pall of judgment and divine displeasure. And so this eyewitness of the tragedy of Jerusalem, this watcher, takes up five songs. And the five chapters of Lamentations are really five dirges, or five laments for the fall of the people of God. The chapters are beautifully constructed in the original Hebrew. In fact, they're acrostics, and each verse starts with a letter of the Hebrew alphabet. And that is why, since there are 22 letters in the Hebrew alphabet, if you look, chapter 1 has 22 verses, chapter 2 has 22 verses, chapter 3, which is bang in the middle, has 66 verses, because he goes through the letters three times, 3 times 22, and then in chapter 4, he goes back to 22, and in chapter 5, 22. It's beautifully constructed. And each poem, each chapter, is a lament which views the tragedy of God's people from a different angle, like five photographs of a disaster area, all taken from different angles. I can recall towards the end of the Second World War, the bombing of Hiroshima. And I recall as a boy seeing a series of photographs in black and white taken of the disaster area. The first photograph was taken from the actual plane which dropped the bomb. And you could see through the window of the plane this hideous mushroom cloud poking its way through the natural clouds of heaven. That was photograph one. Another was taken from a height above the town of Hiroshima, and it was looking down on the town, and you could see the long boulevards and the streets and all the houses and the trees all shredded to pieces with the blast. And another photograph was taken from the ground level, looking flat across the land, and so on. And compositely, they gave a picture of the scale of the horror. And so in Lamentations, each of these five chapters is a poem which looks at the devastation of the work of God. One of them concentrates on the anger of God. Another concentrates on the depopulation of the land. Another concentrates on the breakdown of religion and public worship, and so on. Photographs from different angles of a momentous national tragedy. And as you might expect, there are consistent themes running through all these five poems. And two of the themes stand out. The first is the theme of guilt. There is a consciousness in Lamentations that the nation and the church are guilty before God. They have brought this on their own heads, and they are responsible for the mess. It's no good blaming God. You can't blame God for the mess. The mess has been brought down on our own heads. And so there is this feeling of guilt right throughout Lamentations. You can see it, for example, in chapter 1 and verse 5. Our foes have become the head, our enemies prosper, because the Lord has made her suffer for the multitude of her transgressions. There is a moral explanation for spiritual disaster. If you look on to verses 8 and 9, same idea. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, sinned grievously, and therefore she became filthy. there is a moral reason for spiritual disaster. Verse 9, her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her latter end. Therefore, her fall is terrible. There is a moral explanation for spiritual disaster. You find it again in verse 22 of that same first chapter, where Jerusalem wishes on her enemies all that has happened to her. And she says in verse 22, let all their evil doing come before thee, and deal with them as thou hast dealt with me because of all my transgressions. A moral reason for spiritual disaster. You find it again if you look on to chapter 2 and verse 14, where the heart of the nation's sickness is traced to the ministry. Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. Your prophets have not exposed your iniquity to restore your fortunes. A faithless ministry, afraid to expose the sins of the church, a moral reason for spiritual disaster. If you look over into the third chapter, the same theme of guilt predominates in chapter 3 and verse 40, where Jerusalem comes to her senses and starts to pray. And here is the prayer in chapter 3 and 40. Jerusalem says, let us test and examine our ways and return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven. That's prayer. That's what we need to get back to. It's prayer. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven and say, we have transgressed and rebelled, and thou hast not forgiven. A moral explanation for a spiritual disaster. If you look over into chapter 4, this same theme is picked up there. Chapter 4 and verse 13. This was for the sins of her prophets, the ministers, and for the iniquities of her priests, the ministers, who shed in the midst of her, by their careless preaching, the blood of the righteous. The Old Testament teaches that ministers who don't preach the word of God are guilty of the blood of those who hear. That's the plain teaching of the Old Testament. When a minister does not tell his congregation the truth, he is guilty of the blood of his hearers. This was for the sins of her prophets and the iniquity of her priests, who shed in the midst of her the blood of the righteous. How solemn that is. That's very solemn. Verse 22 in the same chapter. The punishment for your iniquity, O Zion, is accomplished. The moral reason for the spiritual disaster. And lastly, in chapter 5, the same theme of guilt. Chapter 5 and verse 7. Our fathers have sinned and are no more, and we are bearing their iniquities. The IVF commentary has a very fine comment here in its introduction to Lamentations. And the commentator in the InterVarsity Fellowship commentary says that there is, quote, a deep sense of guilt permeating the book of Lamentations. And that is, in a real sense, the true heart of the tragedy that has overtaken the church and overtaken the nation. Unfaithful ministers and unfaithful office bearers, prayerless, careless, lackadaisical office bearers who sleep while the population dances its way to perdition. Church and nation are guilty before God. The second theme running through Lamentations is the theme of hope. And there always has to be hope for God's dealings with his children. Never end in mere tragedy or mere disaster. A Christian church under judgment is still God's church. God's people under judgment are not just any people. They are still God's people. And so beyond the dark clouds and beyond these judgments that are God's strange work, there is always a word of hope that God is going to break through the darkness to heal his people and to revive his work and to restore and reinstate his church. You find this word of hope, for example, in chapter 3 and verse 21. These are great words. I find this very comforting. Chapter 3 and verse 21. And the watcher is sitting on the rubbish heap, rather downcast. And this is what he says, "But this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope." And this is what he calls to mind: "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases." Takes courage to say that sitting on a midden, sitting in an empty church. Takes courage. "This I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning." Here's the great phrase: "Great is thy faithfulness." That's where the hymn comes from. "The Lord is my portion," says my soul, "and therefore I will hope in him. The Lord is good to those who wait for him, even under judgment. To the soul that seeks him, it is good that one should wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. It is good for a man that he should bear the yoke in his youth." A word of hope. If you look over to chapter 5, the whole book ends with a word of hope. In God's sovereignty, chapter 5 and verse 19, here's a last confession of faith: "But thou, O Lord, dost reign forever." Even in a situation of judgment, God reigns. "And thy throne endures to all generations." And why, therefore, dost thou forget us forever? Why dost thou so long forsake us? Restore us to thyself, O Lord, that we may be restored. And so the last word in the book is a word of hope. Now I want to look this evening at these 12 verses which we read from the first chapter. And here in chapter 1, you have three of the hallmarks of a church when it is under judgment. Well, think of these three hallmarks this evening. First of all, empty shrines. You find that in verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was once full of people. How like a widow has she become, she that was once great among the nations. And that is the position of the church very largely in our land tonight, with very, very few exceptions. And the exceptions prove the rule. And the rule is, how lonely sits the city that was full of people. Empty shrines are a primary hallmark of the judgment of God. Let me show you what I mean. Now, I don't tell you these facts to depress you. I'm trying to inform you in order that you may arm yourself for the church's future. I was on holiday in Edinburgh recently, and a week past Monday I went to a minister's fraternal in Edinburgh. And there we shared our problems and our cares as ministers. And one man spoke of his concern for the state of the work of Christ in his area of Edinburgh. And the position was this. There were five churches in that area. Five magnificent buildings, like gigantic wedding cakes in Portland stone. All towers and spires and ornaments and memorial windows and memorial tables and memorial lecterns and memorial fonts. Absolutely magnificent buildings. Very fine architecturally, well turned out, and all of them listed buildings of historical and national importance, and still standing in quite a good area of Edinburgh. One minister has just died, so there's a vacancy. Another minister has just left, so there's another vacancy. The problem is, should these two congregations be united? Well, what about the other three churches? Well, one of them is bankrupt and cannot possibly keep going. Another has a membership of just over 300 and about 60 elderly people come to church on a Sunday morning. One of the ministers actually went there recently to a morning service to see what it was like. There was no evening service, of course. That's carrying religion a bit far, isn't it? It would interfere with the minister's golf Sunday afternoon. I know ministers who spend the Lord's Day playing bridge and chess and watching television. The minister went to a morning service. There were 60 elderly people there, and there was one couple under the age of 40. Now, it would be easy to work out why all of that had happened. Perhaps the population had moved somewhere else. Well, that wasn't the whole truth, for the churches are still surrounded by houses. There are people in the houses. The basic truth is this, that here are people who have failed to pass on the faith of Christ. They have failed to evangelize their neighbors. They have failed to pass on the gospel of our salvation to the next generation. And any church today, in our hard, competitive world, which fails to evangelize its neighbors and pass on the gospel to the next generation, is a church which is already on its way to closure. And at the conclusion of the fraternal, one of the ministers told us that he had been working out the rates of decline in Edinburgh churches, at present evidenced. And he had come to the conclusion that if that rate of decline goes on, there will be one church in Edinburgh in the year 2000. How many churches would there be in Aberdeen by the end of the century? Since Aberdeen has the worst attendance rates at worship in the whole country, it was revealed by the recent National Bible Society survey. How many churches would be standing in Aberdeen? Surely I've told you of one of the most ancient churches in Aberdeen, St. Nicholas, once St. Nicholas Cathedral. There were two cathedrals in Aberdeen. St. Macher's was a Celtic foundation and was the kirk for old Aberdeen. But down near the harbour, they built St. Nicholas Cathedral. It's now on Union Street, of course. But then it was the Sailors' Church, because St. Nicholas is the patron saint of sailors. In St. Nicholas Church today, there are seven congregations under one roof. And there aren't 100 people at the morning service. And how many churches will there be in Inverness by the year 2000? If we don't evangelize our neighbors and pass on Christ to the next generation. James, Philip and I, 2 years ago, we went to the Three Choirs Festival down in Worcestershire. Lovely. But on Sunday, we found it impossible to find a place open for worship on a Sunday evening. So we scoured the villages round Worcestershire in the car. We could find nothing at all in the city of Worcester. We couldn't find a place of worship in Worcester. And in the villages in Worcestershire, we could find nothing but boarded up churches or places with no evening worship at all, until at long last, after some long weary wanderings round the villages, we found ourselves in Malvern, beautiful Malvern. I said, "Oh, Jim, stop the car, I hear bells." I think he thought I was mad. He said, "Stop the car, I hear bells." So we stopped, and there was an evening service in Malvern Priory. That stupendous, magnificent pre-Reformation priory. There were 40 people at the evening service. We all sat in the choir stalls where the monks used to sit. And we discovered that they were the local evangelical Christians, and that was the remnant. Outside, they were playing cricket on the green, drinking sherry, watching television, reading the Sunday Times. Empty shrines, a primary sign of judgment. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow has she become, she that was great among the nations. Second sign is departed friends. Chapter 1 and verse 2. She weeps bitterly in the night. One of the commentators points out the church shouldn't be weeping bitterly through the night. It should be sleeping. That's why God gave us the night and beds, for rest, not for weeping. But here's a church that weeps bitterly in the night, tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her, and all her friends have dealt treacherously with her. But the friends have departed. Now, of course, we know that Israel's friends and lovers were her neighbors. The great empires of the Middle East. Now Egypt, now Assyria, now Babylon, now Greece. All during her history, Israel courted these friends and lovers. One by one, they failed the people of God. One by one, they let Israel down. One by one, they proved themselves unable to save. And one by one, the friends and lovers came under the hammer of the judgment of God. And so the church is left without her friends and her lovers. And the Christian church too has had her false lovers and her friends, you know, ever since the Reformation. I'm convinced that ever since the Reformation, the Christian church in Scotland has been bedeviled by a false alliance with the state. Just as in England, where the Reformation was not so much a spiritual movement as a political tactic by Henry VIII. At times in Scotland, the state and the church have almost been married. And you may not believe this, but it's true. John Calvin believed in a national church. Where on earth in the Bible do you get evidence for a national church? John Calvin said that the state was under an obligation to acknowledge God and the rightness of God's ways and the truth of God's laws. That's partly why, you know, we still have some Christian precepts on the statute books of our land. The precepts on marriage and adultery and remarriage and the Lord's Day as the Christian Sabbath. These are in our statute books because they were put there by Christians who believed that the government under God was obliged under God to acknowledge the church and the work of God and the gospel of God. You still see this marriage of church and state in the crowning of our Queen. You know that the Queen is crowned in a place of Christian worship, and she's crowned according to Christian ceremony. But it has been suggested that when Charles becomes king, he could well be crowned in a secular way to accommodate the times, just like the kings and queens of Sweden and of Holland. There are monarchies in Sweden and Holland, but they are not Christianized monarchies like the monarchy in this land. And what would happen if Charles became a Buddhist? Because it's common knowledge in the South that Prince Charles is interested in Eastern religions. Could a Buddhist wear the crown? State and church, married, false friends and false lovers. You still see it in what used to be called the kirking of the town council. Some of you can remember the days when the town councils were all kirked. They were marched to church where they were prayed for and preached at in full robes of pomp and glory. Well, that's fast becoming a thing of the past. Many of today's counselors are secularists and humanists and decline to go to church to be kirked. And those who do don't go in fancy robes, they go in lounge suits. Until comparatively recently in Scottish history, it was the local laird or the duke or the landowner who paid the minister's salary. It was the marriage of church and state. It was Christians having false friends and false lovers. And it was an admission that the state and the church somehow owed an allegiance to each other. I was speaking to a farmer recently who was gurning to me that he still had to pay a sum of money to the local church. It was the relic of some tithe or another from his lands. Well, the friends and lovers sure are departing. It has been suggested openly that Parliament should no longer be opened with a word of prayer as it is now. It's the first thing that happens in Parliament every day. When the proceedings open, the chaplain stands up and offers a prayer for the day's proceedings. It's been suggested that the bishops should no longer be allowed to sit in the House of Lords as the Lords spiritual of the realm, although some might think that no great loss to the House of Lords. It has been openly suggested that the Queen no longer needs private chaplains when she comes to Scotland, and that that office should be abolished. And it is openly suggested that the Christian churches should no longer be recognized as charities, and that the benefits from covenanted income, income tax covenanted income, that scheme, should cease. And if that happened, virtually every church in Britain would be bankrupt in a matter of 3 months. The Church of Scotland would be bankrupt in 3 months if that happened. Second sign of judgment is departed friends. She weeps bitterly in the night, tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her, and all her friends have dealt treacherously with her. And lastly and thirdly, the third evidence or hallmark of judgment is forsaken feasts. Chapter 1 and verse 4. The roads to Zion mourn, for none come to the appointed feasts. All her gates are desolate. And it cannot be denied that the feasts of the Lord have been forsaken in this generation. It is common knowledge that the number of children now being baptized has fallen astronomically, because some young, secularly minded parents, humanistic parents, won't go to the bother of taking a child to church for baptism. The numbers prepared to come to the Lord's Supper falls every year. Did you know that in the past 15 or 20 years, the Church of Scotland each year has lost between 10,000 and 15,000 members each year? Somebody worked out that by the year 2000, there wouldn't be a Church of Scotland. it won't come to that, because God can step in and God can revive, rescue and save us. But that's the rate of decline in Scotland. I can still recall a day when ministers, usually of the old school who were brought up in a liberal tradition, used to boast about the vast communion services in their churches. You could hear one saying, we'd over 400 out today. It was marvelous to see them again. People, some of whom had scarcely been there since the last communion. As if it were a good thing to see a church crowded at communion when it isn't crowded on every other Sunday. That's a tragedy. Well, that day has gone, hasn't it? People don't come to the feasts anymore. You can get a crowd on Christmas Eve. That's because people are still fascinated by babies. You can manipulate a baby, can't you? You look down into a cradle at a baby. You never get a crowd on Good Friday. The church is deserted on Good Friday. You see, you can manipulate a baby, but you cannot manipulate a man on a cross. You can look down on a baby, but you cannot look down on a man on a cross. And even our Easter communions get thinner now. Empty shrines, departed friends, and forsaken feasts. These, says the watcher, are the hallmarks of a Jerusalem that is under the anger of God. And there is a true and a living way out of all of that, because judgment never is the last word. Tragedy, disaster are never the last word. There is a way back and a way out. And it is to come to Jesus. It's to come back to Christ. Because Christ also is watching the ruins of Zion. He is looking at the mess. And he suffers in the sufferings of his children. And he identifies himself with the sufferings of the church. And he is afflicted in all the church's afflictions. And Christ tonight asks you to look at him and to come back to him and to re-examine your life in the light of verse 12. In closing, hear the voice of Christ, the Christ who suffers with the church. Hanging on the cross, he says, and he looks into your eyes tonight. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look and see. If there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on me, says Jesus, on the day of his fierce anger. Examine yourself. Examine your life. Examine your religion. Examine your domestic affairs. Examine your spiritual affairs. Examine the state of your soul. Where do you stand tonight as Jesus says to you? is it nothing to you? All you who pass by. Amen. May the Lord add a blessing to his holy word.